Hi, my name's Giovanni Ribisi, and I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey, welcome back, Ben. You're still wearing the same clothes as last time.
I know. I what I do is every week I rotate them on a regular basis, but so are you. So
yeah, yes, exactly right.
We've hit on the same schedule day. We're like Seth Brundle from The Fly. We only have one set of clothes so that we don't waste any brain space thinking about what to wear.
In reality, we just basically ended our host wraps for episode part one of this two-parter, and now we're doing part two. So Ben, who is on part two? Whose part two are we doing?
It's Giovanni Ribisi's part two.
That's right.
For God's sake.
Giovanni Ribisi, back to complete the conversation we had with him a few weeks ago, all about Strange Darling, which is in a theater now. You should go see it. It is great.
Please.
Go see it. Go support indie film. Go support a movie shot on film. Go support a movie that is got, you know, fantastic performances, and it's a dark noir, semi-thriller horror kind of thing. And God, it's just not like things that you've seen before. So go support.
That's so
that.
Good. It reminds me of like it sort of reminds me of the heyday of indie cinema in the 90s when you would just go see movies that were like playing with the form and doing innovative stuff and maybe didn't have the biggest, most lavish budget, but like were never boring and held your attention completely.
J.T. Mahler, the director of this, and Giovanni Ribisi have made a fantastic movie. Go out and see it in the theater. It's definitely worth it. And if you're in Los Angeles, you can go see it on film at the Vista, which is really cool.
I'm going to try and do that.
Yeah, you should do that. So here we are with part two of our interview with Giovanni Ribisi.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
Typically, cinematographers are pretty risk-averse. How much of this stuff are you testing before going in? Hair, makeup, lighting, all of the above? What's your testing
all
schedule look like?
Yeah. I did so many different tests on the color blue in my own shop. I called at one point a good friend of mine who's a visual effects makeup artist, and I said, hey, do you have anything that's like a photorealistic head so I can have a stand-in so I didn't have to pay somebody to sit there 8 hours a day while I'm lighting and moving lights around and put it. So he sent me this guy, this bust of a guy who's like, we call him Herman.
Yep.
My kids named him Herman the Ding Dong. Because he just looks so stupid, just and so you know, I got Herman, and I just, you know, experimented and did certain things, and you know, again, I also have a technical sort of interest in the Da Vinci and coloring and all that stuff. So I went in and manipulated certain things and got it to not a place that I was happy, but you know, at a certain point, you do need to let the pros do what they're doing. You do have to delegate responsibility. That's really important. But but yeah, so for that, we did definitely, and all the tests were based on the conversations that JT and I would have, and JT was there with us. We tested diffusion and levels of diffusion, and how that would react with certain you know, with 216 or 250 on the lights, colors, what happens when you shoot daylight stock in tungsten, which is an obvious question, but it's great to do things that are, you know, that, you know, why not? And so you know, it was months of that. It was definitely months of that. And it doesn't need to be expensive. I mean, you could do tests on 16 millimeter, you know, and answer certain questions that you have that you come up with, which is part of the creative process. It's not just coming up with an idea. It's coming up with the inversion of that idea, which is the question. Well, what color do I want it to be? Well, go, you know, but you can do certain things on 16, or you can do, you know, you can test lenses, you can test composition, you know, certain thing, and get into like what a 32 does versus an 18 when you put this at that angle, you know, all of that, which is just massively important. And it's also fun, and it's so worthwhile. It's so worthwhile. We also did tests with a digital camera. I had an old Arri Alexa studio, that, you know, I just wanted to sit down and be able to have a live real time conversation with JT and a monitor and show him what the lenses that we were going to be using did.
You go back and you look at like previous work of the of your cast then for this? Are you looking at like Dinner in America? Are you looking at Willa Fitzgerald's previous work? What do you do to prepare to make sure that you're putting the cast in the best possible or the light that you'd like to put them in?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of that is looking at photographs and features, and it's not there's so many different ways to view that. Sometimes you want to, you know, and again, it all comes from character.
Yeah,
you do that. And again, you know, and you inform that it's not always about lighting or only lighting. And it's also not always about trying to enhance or complement the character. You know, sometimes something needs, it's about the story and mm-hmm. what that person's going through. And, you know, there's that. And then there's also, you know, the other end of the spectrum. I think it was Harris Savides, who was a director that I knew that worked with him. And he said, I light environments, meaning like I'm not focused, yeah. You know, I'm looking at the bigger picture and then let how our actors and the dynamics of their relationships inform that. And then when you obviously going in for closer is a little different, and it's again going back to objectivity going into subjectivity, and what are we experiencing? Nobody, and this is so obvious, spoke to the idea of the possibilities of film and an audience experience more than Kubrick, right? When you have 2001, even Eyes Wide Shut, where you have, if you look at the way the actors are behaving, it's this very sort of automated plotting thing that's speaking even slightly slower, and there's a style to it that is sort of almost not human and not coming from a real place.
Kind of like David Lynch in a way, he finds an angle that doesn't feel, it's not what we're used to seeing in other movies. But also talk about somebody who would test, you know, like on 2001, he was constantly using Polaroids even to take
the wide lux, right?
Yeah. And it was to like figure out the latitude and to figure out what would be seen. You know, that was the only way. They didn't have video assist even. That was the only way to even know what they were getting.
I was just working with a friend who was making a movie over 2 years that I was involved in and helping with my facility and the whole thing. And he was just making his movie. Incredible. And what he did was something truly that we have never seen before. And it's great. And it's, and I mean, at one point, you know, I think I don't know how much he spent, but it was, you guys would be shocked. I mean, we were shooting IMAX and, you know, 65 and mostly on film, rehashing VistaVision and Technirama in those formats, you know, 20 some odd years ago when we saw digital cameras coming off on the horizon. I said to my friend who's a filmmaker, I said, you know, wow, so anybody's going to be able to make a film. I mean, my kid, you know, 15-year-olds, and he's like, no. If they were going to make a film, they would be doing it already.
Correct.
Right. You know, it's really, there's more than just the tool and the camera and the whole thing.
Yeah. In the same way that word processing didn't turn us into a world of novelists, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
maybe the opposite of that. Yeah. We definitely have a lot of ideas and opinions that we want to out there on our Motorola microphones, you know, like,
The one thing about Strange Darling is that it really plays on expectations. The whole movie, it sets you up one way. It makes you examine your preconceptions of what things are. And I'm going to not give anything away here. And I think we've done a great job.
I don't spoil it for anyone, but I do tell people it's a puzzle box. Like, yeah, that's
absolutely. I want everyone to go in as completely blank and as dark as I did into this, which is not watching a trailer, not watching read anything, which I think is the perfect way to see this. But I wanted to ask you about expectations because the way that the movie reveals itself, it changes your expectations. You think that you understand the situation and then it changes your understanding of the situation. Was that part of what attracted you to this project? What is your thought about the idea of the changing expectations and sort of revealing the actual story as you go through?
I think that was one of the things that, I mean, it really, when you read the script, it gets you. I mean, like it, I did not see it coming the way JT put it together, and he did it in 83 pages. And I hope one day that somebody will take an interest in publishing this thing, because it really is, the thing that about it as well is that, you know, so yeah, it is a nonlinear plot and you go, well, you know, snooze fest. But no, this is
not at all.
It's the evolution of that, right? And the way he did it is like nothing we've ever seen. But he, the thing about it was the elegance of it, you know, how simple it is. But you know, you kind of have, in order to get to that simplicity, you have to go around the world and have
simple
everything.
Is not easy. Oh yeah.
And it reminds me of just now of the idea that, you know, an intelligent person speaks in sort of terse concepts, unlike myself, goes on and on, turns everything into a story. But you know, like so that's the idea. Is that it really is that it's, and it's really smart when you take the 7 different elements that need to happen in order to take this story. And then that's the playground for the actors, you know, really kind of amazing in that way.
Was there any kind of thought that went into, and I honestly don't know if there is, you know, there's a lot of scenes that when you watch the movie a second time, the first time you see it, you're walking in with a bunch of preconceptions and you assume certain status things about the characters or who's the good guy, who's the bad guy and stuff like that. And that kind of stuff all gets inverted over the course of the movie. So was there any thought about like, we're going to shoot it like this is the scene where this person's the threat, but really the threat's coming from somewhere else, so that if I watch it again, I'll be like, oh, I get it. Like, I guess what's the magic trick of that, of pulling it off so that it's both truthful and misleading?
Yeah, I guess there was that. And as you know, I've been around for, you know, all my life, really, and I'm now becoming an old man, and I'm
welcome.
I think we're all contemporary Gen Xers here. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But you know, after 40 years, I've definitely seen stories where, you know, it becomes about wanting to pull the wool over somebody's head and shoot it in a certain way, but then maybe possibly leave Easter eggs in there where, like, if you would have known all along, oh, it was there right in front of us, under our noses. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. I mean, I think that was actually kind of a big, a, 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 um, a conversation in the 90s that we would have oftentimes when we were like talking about things, especially with acting and all that. But for me, I don't know. I thought it was, I was curious to come at it more from a geometrical point of view, as far as like shapes on the screen, lighting, and just when the camera moved and when it didn't move, right? So like restraint. I've spoken to a lot of cinematographers who have said, you know, oh, well, I actually directed that movie.
I've worked on some of those.
Yeah, one or two. Yeah.
For me, you know, when you are writing,
yeah,
going through production, dealing with studios, dealing with actors, dealing with everything, surviving production, especially in this day and age, and then you go and edit, and then you make the choices of the music, and then the, you know, nobody's directing the movie other than the director, period. I mean, you know, yes, there's definitely times when producers come in and people come in and they take over and they take the, you know, and obviously that, I think I have never heard of an instance where that was successful or that didn't become a horror show in and of itself. So at the end of the day, yes. So at the end of the day, you know, looking at the geometry and the importance of that and the lighting and how that all comes together, the composition, the camera movement, and what to emphasize there, you know, it really is JT. I mean, it really is him looking at this and having time in the edit to go rhythmically, what we're doing here is going to inform the shapes that are on screen that we're looking at over there, where the eye goes and all that, you know? And so I think that that was, I guess, that, I hope that answered your question.
Yeah. No, I think it really does. But it makes me think of something else. I mean, the different roles, and I know you directed an episode of Sneaky Pete, which was an awesome show. You've had, you know, you produced this movie, you've got a wide variety of skill sets.
I didn't even know about the VFX thing.
Yeah, I didn't know the VFX either, which is super cool. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, exercising these muscles. These are different muscles. If you want to do, you know, look, you can be the jack of all trades, master of none, but if you want to do any of these crafts well, it's work, it's preparation. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got a tremendous
amount of prep. What it sounds like you did.
a tremendous amount of prep as a cinematographer, as a DP, to go into any feature. It's not something you pull out the camera and go, you know, here we go. And same thing for an actor. Actors got to prepare for roles. Directors have to prepare. Can you talk a little bit about the intensity or amount of prep work that you yourself, like, just use yourself as the example. How much work do you have to do to prepare for any of these different tasks?
I think that's a great question. And I've always looked at it in a way, which I don't, maybe this is insignificant, but where there's the idea of the creative process and having good ideas for something, and then also being able to execute those ideas. But before that, there is the imagination and of looking at, well, what could you possibly do in order to be prepared? Like, and that to me is like, is part of the whole process, is sitting down for a moment, like, wow, well, maybe we could do tests. Well, how would we be able to afford tests? Nobody can afford tests. Well, wait, maybe we could, you know, oh, I found the little research and did the thing in this day and age, and now you can go to the Kodak film shop and buy film for 25 cents on the dollar, and go and do tests that aren't necessarily perfect because this film's a little expired, but it gets you there. It answers some questions if you keep your eyes open and your imagination, you use your imagination. And so part of that is having the imagination for the process of getting there, which it sounds stupid, but it really is like, what are the possibilities? How could you throw yourself into this? And I think a lot of that comes from acting, you know? I think that most of that comes from, I guess, again, the Actor's Studio, where it was, it's almost, method acting has almost become a pejorative idea these days, and almost, you know, people laugh at it, but I don't know. For me, it wasn't necessarily about staying in character, which is part of an imaginative process, right? I mean, the person that had the most imagination as far as how somebody could dive into a role would be Stanislavski, right? Because he wrote, here's all the possible things that you could do. The notion of the magic if that he had, that he came up with, which was incredible for any creative person. But yeah, again, looking at the possibilities, I think it came from acting, and I think that again, method acting, the diving in and doing anything that you could in order to have an experience as a person, as a character, so that the audience might have an experience, which is the intention of the Actor's Studio and Stanislavski and all of that. And I think that that sort of applies to most disciplines in film. Again, objective into subjectivity, right? I think that that's it. It's just like the other thing is that every film is different. So now you're taking on an entirely different vocation, and you have to, you have to reinvent the wheel for yourself. Right. And I think this is great. It's like you're saying, there's a lot of work that goes into it, and but it's worth it. You know, I mean, what else are you going to do?
which of these, I mean, you've done acting for a long time, you've done producing for a long time, you've now done camera for a long time, which is the hardest to prepare for it, or is it all just different muscles?
The acting thing is that's hard. But I guess it also depends on who you are and what your bent is, you know. I think an engineer has an easier time building a camera than using it, you know. But you know, acting, it's an interesting thing, because you are ultimately trying to do something, and it never ends up being what you're trying to do, because it's a hard thing. It's like if you've ever been drunk at a wedding dancing, and they videoed you,
and then no you comment.
Watch it the next
Maybe
day.
It's true.
You watch it the next day, and you're like, "Oh God, oh my God, I really got into self-expression there." it's a similar thing, you know. So much of acting is about humiliation. So much of the hero's journey with a script and a screenplay is putting somebody through extremity, right? And hurting
torture.
Them. And sending them up a tree and throwing rocks at them, and then they you know, and so, and as an actor, you have to do that, you know. Your job is to try to do that almost subtlety, but you want to have the experience
on cue and hit your marks and be in your light and remember
yeah,
your cues,
right.
remember
well,
all
but
your
that
lines.
But also yeah and then it, you know, it is a communal effort, and so you're also dealing with people who are saying, you know, you didn't hit your mark there, yeah, but the emotion was, you know. And then you think you did something that was interesting or maybe authentic or organic, and then you watch it and it's just the most pretentious, overwrought, horrible version of masturbation that you could, you know, I mean. And so yeah, I there was at one point, I remember that it hit me the first time. I was 9 years old or 10 years old, and I we didn't have cable. Our neighbors had cable, but I had done a cable TV show, and so we went over to the neighbor's house and we all gathered around the television and watched this episode of this show called The New Leave It to Beaver. It was
I remember show. It yeah.
And even at that age, I was mortified at watching myself. And it was like this rude awakening of like, oh my God, it was awful. And I was just embarrassed. And so from there, it just became a lifelong journey of trying every which way to not embarrass myself. So the, you know, I guess maybe just the main thing is just, it's a psychological thing, acting. And, you know, it is this thing, this version of humiliation, you know, in a way, for some people, maybe not for everybody.
But. Sure. Is there a,
yeah, I always find that it takes a certain, lack of self-consciousness. Like if you're too self-conscious, you just get up in your head and you can't do it. And the people who are at it, I think, are the people who can just not get in their head about whatever it is and stay on their task.
That really is a muscle. Hmm. I mean, it's you know, I think people have natural innate talent, but I think also talent is really about how interested you are in something. And how driven and how disciplined, how willful you can be about it. And I think that not being self-conscious is a muscle. I mean, that talking about not being self-conscious, you know, as a cinematographer, you know, I mean, you have to be able to conduct yourself and be comfortable in your skin, you know.
Do you like to operate, by the way? I was wondering the whole time if you were doing the operating.
Yeah, that's a really important. But you know, again, and I offend people. It's a complicated thing. You know, there's rules and restrictions about operating, and it just baffles me. And at a certain point, I just go, I don't care about your rules and restrictions. I want to operate. You know, I'm not a Steadicam operator, and sometimes because I'm smaller and I'm trying to exercise so that I can actually do handhold the camera and hold it out there for as long as certain takes need to go film, you know, and then you're talking about 27 pounds sometimes.
Well, I was wondering about that because I was wondering about, you know, you as an actor, you know, working on blocking and the dance that the camera does in the film when it does dance with the actors. And was I seeing sort of your performance in the operation, but I didn't know if you would operate.
Well, that leads me to like a whole other thing about how much, you know, and I don't know if we did this in Strange Darling, but you know how, and you know, Elia Kazan spoke in regards to directing, you know, that a director should be invisible within the movie. You know, so to answer your question, instinctively, when you have enough work and enough prep and testing, you're developing instincts, right, to be able to answer and solve problems or challenges, or they're not even problems. They're you know, everybody's creating on something, and you're enhancing, and everybody else is enhancing each other, and you want to get into that disposition, that collective disposition on a set, right? So it becomes an instinctual thing that, you know, the camera's here. If you are, for instance, handheld, and you're here, and if you just do that, it's the world. It's what falls in line with what you are doing or what you prepped for and what the language of your film is, right? But as far as from an actor's perspective, you know, you'll work with people who sort of, you know, it's I think it's a lot of times it's often nerves or insecurity about something, but you know, it's it suddenly becomes that's the show there, and you see it in the outcome of their work and the way they behave or comport themselves in a professional manner on a set, where it really becomes about attention. And it becomes about focusing on certain ideas that aren't necessarily looking at the picture holistically.
I mean, I feel like what's interesting talking to you about this, you know, because you are, I mean, like you're a director, you're an actor, you've done all these other things, but like coming at it as a lifelong actor, I feel like you're thinking about the process out loud more
than people who just do this all the time.
Yeah. Okay, and I find it endlessly fascinating because it's very hard sometimes to get people to even get into that process.
DPs can be so reserved about the process too. They can really keep the cards protected, really close to their chest. Yeah. They don't want to reveal all their secret sauces.
I don't care about that, by the way.
And we're here because we're fascinated with this. I'm not a cinematographer. I when I see cinematographers do amazing work like your work, I'm always like, I want to know what was the thought process behind it. I want to know what created that. I don't need to know that you had, you know, a bank of Dido lights that, you know, went up to the sky or whatever. Like, I don't need to know how many condors you had, but it's more just like the creative process that brought it about.
Yeah. Well, so to that, you know, and, you know, I mean, you could throw a one black pro mist on something as opposed to, you know, an eighth or, you know, but, and blow it out and do something that suddenly it becomes, distracting in a way. And sometimes, I mean, you know, we actually did that for the last shot, because it needed to feel like a dream or the last scene with her, not the last shot. You know, I feel like, you know, at the end of the day, you know, everybody, the director really is the last voice. They need to be. And it doesn't matter how you feel about them personally or whatever. And as much as I want to, there's the difference between enhancing something or making yourself known and your presence known in a way that is self-serving, or I don't know, that sounds cliche, you know, and it's a fine line, and you don't have to be an asshole to be self-serving. You know what I mean? It's like you sometimes make that mistake and it becomes overblown, or you go, whatever it is. But I think, you know, as far as like the image is concerned, that's one thing, but also, you know, there's a way of being the grease and helping a production as somebody who is under the director, but over a lot of other people, who is also to a greater or lesser degree being invisible. And just, why is that going so smoothly? Well, there's a lot of work that goes into that to making it feel seamless so that somebody can do their job, the actress, the director, right? But I think that's a responsibility for a lot of people. Because I've experienced this as an actor and directors, and I've been selfish and I've been an asshole as an actor, you know, insecure and whatever, because I didn't trust certain things. And I saw somebody in front of me who was being patient and understanding and being a support system, or creating a support system, for me. And that's just because even if the movie turns out to be shitty, that's a massive portion of your life that you can either go through it being miserable or have something and maybe learn something. Right. So yeah, films are always miracles and they're always impossible. You're always reaching for what you're way beyond what your resources would normally allow for. And that's what you have to do as a filmmaker, as a cinematographer, as a director, as a writer, as an actor, all of that. But you've got to be a team. You've got to ultimately, you know, there was definitely times where I just did not want to use the 21 millimeter lens. And JT really wanted it, and we would discuss it. But at the end of the day, that fucking 20 millimeter lens is going on that camera, period, you know? And it's my job. That's part of the thing is that you got to make that work. just being able to be a support system and the importance of that for the director. Oh yeah, the 21 millimeter lens. Yeah. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, as much as I fought to not have that thing for certain scenes and certain shots, he was right.
So tell me about the satisfaction that comes from, you know, you know, if you're doing a great performance, or if you're being a good, you know, team member, or if you're being a, you know, a good leader of your crew, where does the satisfaction come for you from getting the job done?
Everything, all of it. It's definitely satisfying to be able to have a great working relationship with the people that you are working with, that who are supporting you. Management is a massive part of cinematography. I don't think people really talk about that enough. But at the end of the day, the thing that stands out to me is that a friend of mine said, whenever he shoots digital, he's always a little more disappointed than what he, it's never as good as what he thought it would be. When he views dailies. And film is the opposite. Whenever he shoots film, it's always better than or more. And maybe that's just because we're so inured with the digital image that it's just like film becomes like, oh my God. But, you know, even to that extent, you go, oh, wow, I think that was really interesting. What I was seeing in the viewfinder was like, was magical. It was great. And oh God, I can't wait to see the dailies. And then it's out of focus.
Yeah.
You know, but that's all part of the joy, and those are part of the, you know, those are the stories that you have. So I, you know, I think, but it really is that. I think shooting is you know, and also there's so much more. I'm so excited to look forward. I know that I have so much more in me, in regards to cinematography and to explore and do things. You know, I'm really, interested in VistaVision, and I'm developing, actually retrofitting, I should say, a camera system that is based on another brilliant camera that was made by a guy named Greg Beaumont. And we're just looking at, you know, I guess more or less taking some of the modern tools that we have that weren't at his disposal, which probably would have been in implementing them in the camera. And so that becomes a new, a format that probably this generation hasn't really seen.
We've been hearing about that. Like Robbie Ryan came on the show and he shot parts of Strange Things on VistaVision. And I was like, that's the first time anyone's talked to me about VistaVision ever. You know, and his cameras are just sitting around.
You mean poor things, Ben.
Well, sorry. Poor thing.
Yeah. So yeah, there, you know, it was kind of like a interesting confluence of people asking questions. I got interested in it 2 years ago, and other people, you know, were, and so it's great. It's healthy because, you know, my father was always saying, if you're not innovating as a company or as with your product, then you're falling by the wayside. And this is something that I guess relatively new for film. It's a medium to large format. And the possibilities, you know, again, when you stick an anamorphic lens, on there becomes Technirama, right? And the films that had been shot in Technirama and the tools that they were using back in the 60s, just unbelievable, beautiful.
You've name dropped a lot of, you know, great cinematographers from over the years and stuff. Are there contemporary cinematographers you find inspiring, people whose work you look at and go,
I mean, Robbie great. Ryan.
Yeah, Robbie Ryan. Yeah,
that's Kinds of Kindness.
Good friend of the show. He's great. Yeah.
Also a wonderful guy too. I don't know if you've met him.
Yeah, wonderful.
He's just the sweetest guy.
Oh my God, what a legend. I don't think it gets better than him. It just also, you know, you know, when you look at Poor Things and you've got that, what I think it was a 6mm lens with
the fisheye. Yeah.
It's more than vignetting.
It's
a
like looking through a peephole in your front door.
What he did with the composition and what the lens distortion is doing to the geometry, and he's just incredible. Who else? I don't know. For me, I get a lot of inspiration from right now. It's a big. I'm just. Exploring the universe of the Brits in the 1960s. And then also what people were doing again with VistaVision and the larger format, and how that changes a 50mm lens or a 32mm lens, or what you can put on that camera. Who else is gosh, there's so many great cinematographers. It's just
when you've worked with a bunch of them, you've worked with so many.
You've worked with tons, yeah, too.
Yeah, yeah, sure, yeah. Sal Tatino, who's great, and hired me as an operator recently. And
oh, really?
Yeah,
that's fantastic. Nice.
And really, just been such a supportive person. Reed Morano, who is directing mainly now, but when I worked with her and met her, she was shooting and directing. Great Maddie Libatique. There was actually, I went to a Camera Image 8 years ago. And that was really the moment where I decided, I was a judge with Reed. Reed invited me, and I was with Maddie and Sal Tatino, and Ellen Karras was there. And
One of the best.
Yeah. Oh my God. Incredible. We worked together a long time ago. And it was a moment where I was like, oh, I want to shoot a movie secretly. I was hanging out and getting drunk with all those guys. And, it was just a life-changing experience for me. And I was like, gosh, this is a day in the life of a cinematographer. My God.
Camera Image is kind of the elevated day in the life of the cinematographer. Yeah. That is like you just described the experience of going there. It's a lot of it's a lot of socializing in Poland. Yeah.
So anybody I know who has been there and goes there is like, this is the best film festival in the world. It really is. Those guys are incredible. I mean, because that's a genuine love of film and cinema.
How are you going to pick your projects? Is it only going to be things that you really want to produce too or love?
It depends. It just depends on, I think I'm at a point where, working with people that I don't want to say get along with, because that sounds flaky and, that's a bad caveat, because you're definitively not going to get along at some point, you're going to have a different idea. And you have to be able to work your way out. But I think that the biggest thing for me, even, specifically as an actor, is looking at what a director has done before, and seeing if my own sociological or creative puzzle piece can fit within their bigger picture, and I think that's an important thing. So making that decision or having a viewpoint on that, for me, I guess I'm sort of going along with the flow. But I think that it's complicated and it's different for every scenario. There's just something about that where you grab a camera, you have an idea, you go and and I do that with my kids a lot, as they are growing up, trying to get them into the filmmaking process and understand what that is. But I think that that would be an ideal. So it's not necessarily just about what job I'm doing, but it's really about looking at how we make movies and the freedom that might need, so that you can, you know, if you want to go off and do something that's like less blank, and run around with a 16 millimeter, 8 millimeter camera and tell stories that way, that you're not, you can do that, and you can do that on film, and you can, you know, and it's, so I don't know. I think that, you know, there's a part of me that the answer to that is, we'll just go do it. You know, it's a little more complicated, and I think that there's probably some hurdles within that to understand, but I think that's the idea for me.
Well, it'd be about like how much time you could allot to it too, because like, yeah, if you're the star of a movie, then you're with it the whole run. But if you're a supporting character, you might be in it and out. But if you're a DP, you're with it in pre-production, you're with it all the way through the end.
Yeah. And you have a good understanding of all the different things that, that go into arriving to a certain shot, a setup, a scene.
Yeah.
You know, editorially, photographically, acting wise, directing, you know, and all of that. And that at the end of the day, you know, you can be a jack of all trades and a master of none. But I think that, I don't know, with filmmaking, there is a certain sort of thing. You know, I worked with James Cameron, who is just brilliant and so
jack of all trades, master of all.
Yes,
master of all. Right.
We've talked about that. Him. On
yeah,
the
we've
show
had Russell Carpenter. Times. We've had Russell it's Carpenter like, on a couple of times.
Oh, Russell.
And my first question was like, is it true about James Cameron that he could like literally tap anyone on the shoulder and say you're fired and do their job better? And he was like, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was
boom operator. You're out of here.
And he said he walked over and like was talking about the fill side of a light, you know, being a little bit more cyan or blue, and took it. And then I sort of moved my head and looked at the monitor and saw myself, and it was and the shift, the contrast, the color contrast. It's like bingo, you know, beautiful, brilliant. I do. And I don't want to end off on a negative note, but on you know, the question for me is, would Chaplin or Buster Keaton have been Chaplin and Buster Keaton if they had to deal with the restrictions and the rules and all of the regulations that we are encumbered with in this day and age? And I think not, you know, or if they would have agreed to playing by the rules. They were all about breaking the rules. And that's why when you see City Lights or The Kid or whatever, your life
General.
Yeah, any of those movies. Oh my god. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The train crash in The General. Like no one's made a better train crash to this day.
I was talking to a cinematographer from India at this last Camera Image, and I was like, what's the difference of making movies in America? You know, like what do you he said, well, we usually have 100 days to shoot a movie. And we go around, we do a location scout and we look up at a building that's crumbling down and we say, maybe we could get a crane up there. You just put the crane up.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, and I'm not encouraging people to be dangerous, but there was a great quote from Tom Cruise where he said, don't be careful, be competent.
Mm. Yeah, that is a great quote, actually.
Right? Yeah. And this is when he's jumping off a cliff.
Yeah. On a motorcycle. Highly competent. Right?
Incredible. And so I don't know. That's for me, you know, I don't want to hear people complain. I'm sorry. I don't want to go through another strike. I just want to go and make movies and I don't want to complain about that. I just want to go and be responsible for my own condition and let somebody else be responsible for theirs. You know, and that's it. I think that's the most, I don't know. That's probably sounds really self. I don't know. Somebody pissing people off right now.
I think that's actually, I think that's a really great way to leave it, but I still have like two more, one more thing I want to ask you, which is like,
sure.
It almost sounds like in this last answer, it's like, in some ways you're calling for a renaissance or an advocacy sort of for the return of the independent studio, the return of the independently minded, the return of
which is what this film feels like, by the way. This film reminds me of the best of like the 90s.
You took the words out of my mouth, Ben. That's exactly what I was going to say. It's like, it reminds me, it feels like a kind of a throwback, and not just because there's a little bit of like a film 70s sort of aesthetic, but set in sort of like a contemporary era. There is a real independent perspective and vision. And it's at the same time familiar, but also something I haven't seen before. And that is so hard.
That's so great. I mean, do you remember like when you would go to the theater and see like Run Lola Run and you'd be like, I have no idea what I'm about to walk into.
And also no idea where this movie is going, which is also like, it's like, so rarely do I feel like that happens. I think the last time I think I really, really felt like before this movie, like, I have no idea what's going to happen next. Might have been like No Country for Old Men. Like halfway through No Country for Old Men, I'm like, what the hell is going to happen now? And it's like, I was feeling that again here, which is like, what an accomplishment. How great is that? It's so good to not to be, you know, more than a step ahead of your audience, but still include them to have them come along that journey, which is great. So,
well, there was also that thing that, you know, I think that for so many reasons, and a lot of it is, you know, above the line and actors' paychecks and all that. There was a Scorsese had talked about at one point in a documentary where he said that he likes to watch a lot of the older B movies, Joseph Losey and those direct, you know. Because they weren't encumbered by massive budgets, and therefore their stock in trade was really about taking chances and being able to be experimental, because you know the studio isn't betting the farm, and you know the producers didn't really care about it as much or whatever, for whatever reason, and I think that speaks to, you know, today. I think that you don't need, I mean, the people are spending $200 million on a thriller. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a true statement.
Yeah.
That's not overblown or exaggerated, you know, and sometimes more. And I just think that there's a smarter way to do things where you can ultimately, I'm not trying to get on some chariot and like wave a flag, you know, that's just the way I want to do it, you know? And so I do have my own little facility that I've amassed a bunch of shit over the last 50 years.
Everyone has got a facility. Charlie, says the same thing. Yeah,
I'm kind of in my facility right now.
Everyone's right. Me too. All
right. You have a store. You have a genuine camera store.
Right. Yeah. I just want to go, you know, make things and do things. Strange Darling was more or less an experiment for the place to. And, wasn't without its wrinkles, but you know, we fixed those issues, and I think, you know, I'm just excited to go off and do the next thing. And again, you know, I've had my own businesses, and I've had, you know, and when you're assigning certain responsibilities to people, you know, and you're spending a lot of money, and sometimes you're spending a certain amount of money that where it doesn't go off, your business is over. And that has happened with studios, and that's happened with big studios, that I can see that there's significance or importance put on certain decisions, creative decisions. And then you find people saying, well, that worked and that made a lot of money. So that, you know, at least that'll cover our asses if we just do the same thing. And what was that guy who at the Academy Awards who said, you know, you guys are spending $200 million on one movie. Well, why don't we spend $20 million on 10 movies?
Yeah.
Or something to that effect. And there's that idea seems to make sense. But, you know, again, rules and regulations, you got, I mean, when we got into doing the budget on this thing, you have to be made of a certain sort of, looking at it, and you know, because so many people will talk about the greedy producer, and no, I'm sorry. I mean, it is one of the hardest jobs, a line producer job, a first AD who's in the director's guild, but still they're part of they're that bridge. It is, it's a certain gene that I have so much respect for, and the pressure, and you know, anyways.
Dude, this is so great.
Almost 2 hours.
And
oh really? Oh my gosh! Wow.
Yeah, but you know, you're in a unique club though. Bradford Young, Wally Pfister. Only a few people have kind of like gone like the 2 hours or 3 hours with us. Like have done these.
Oh
like,
my
things.
Gosh.
We've broken them up into multiple episodes. And Giovanni, we would love to have you back and do this again sometime. This is the type of conversations that we are into. This is not like a wham bam, get a soundbite and go. We want to delve into the stuff. That's the good stuff. That's where the good stuff is. So
agreed.
I'm so glad that we got to do this. So
well, the pleasure's been all mine. It's been a privilege, really.
So thank you so much for giving us all this time. Seriously, where can people find you or your work or Strange Darling, or where would you like to point people online if they want to interact with you or your work?
Well, I don't. Yeah, I haven't really. I'm not really, honestly, I'm not familiar with social media. That sounds pretentious. And
no, you have like five extra hours in the day than most of us do.
And you know what? That is very typical of DPs. DPs do not do any social media. So,
but you know, the movie is coming out August 23rd. So domestic, it's coming. They're releasing it in, I believe somewhere around 1500 screens. It'll be Sweet. At the Alamo Draft House and Regal Cinemas. And then it's also coming out, internationally, I think theatrically as well, in most European markets in Australia. And so, yeah, I think the big date. Oh, you know, just as an aside, you'll probably, I don't know, but JT just won Best Director at the Bouchon International Festival, which is
Sweet.
High praise, because Fantastic. I think the South Koreans really know what they're doing, especially with genre movies, you know. So we're all so proud of him for that, and well-deserved. And yeah, that's it.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, and just please come back when you have your next film.
I'd love to. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.